spring, and I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and right now, of course, we're going to be talking to General Ben Parton. Now, our telephone numbers, we'll give those out if we want any calls, but please don't call in until we ask for it, because General Parton is going to be talking about the move towards world government. You know, and we talk a lot about that. A lot of people say, oh, well, this really couldn't be true. After all, if there was a move towards world government, why certainly Rush Limbaugh would tell us, and Rush Limbaugh tells us that there's only kooks and people who believe in black helicopters who believe that there's this globalist movement, and Sean Hannity and all these people who make so much money by telling the people lies. And I always look upon Rush Limbaugh. He's one of the cleverest, one of the finest entertainers I know. I love to listen to him, but I always think of him as the best conservative money could buy, because he knows what's going on. He just doesn't want, well, he just doesn't telling people for some reason what's going on. General Parton, what's this about globalism and the move to do away with our sovereignty as an individual nation?
Well, this program has been going on for a long time. I dare say it's been organized, and you can trace this organization and the people who are participating in it back for many, many decades. Even back by the time this country was founded, the organization was out there to transform this world into this new world order. But I think on the last program, I don't think we have probably a new audience.
It's a totally new audience, so you can go ahead and say exactly what you said before.
Okay. The organization of the people and the preparation of the continuity of the program and keeping it up to date was put together in its most elaborate and most complete form at the after the Soviet Union was founded and the Third International was founded in 1918. You'll find that many things in the previous decades, in fact two centuries before, you'll find many things in the program of the Third International that were spelled out in earlier programs. But the program of the Third International is the most definitive, most widely approved by a worldwide organization, really. And it's the Bible they're still going by, and if you study the program, you can understand where they are in the program and where they're going. I know Anatoly Golitsyn, who was a Soviet defector when he was posted to Finland, wrote a book back there, New Lies for All, I think sometime around 1984, in which he said the Sino-Soviet split was a strategic disinformation program. I had written a book 20 years earlier based on the program of the Third International. I said the Sino-Soviet split was a hoax. And I was saying that based on my studies of the progress of what they'd been doing for many, many decades. And he was saying this from an internal, educated, high-level participant in the program. But when they set up the Third International in 1918, Lenin International, they set up a separate committee to pull together what they call the program of the Third International. And when you hear the word program, when you're talking about the communist world, socialist world, whatever you want to call it, it's that organization out there working for this new world order on a global scale.
Hold that thought here, General. We'll be right back in just a moment. Here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Our guest this afternoon is General Ben Parton. He's with the military. He's retired from the military. He was an explosives expert, traveled throughout the world. But now, of course, he's also still involved in trying to defend our country. And he's doing that by trying to explain to people about this move towards globalism, this long-term move that's pretty been going on for several hundred years. to try to bring about a world government. He makes the point that this was here even at the time when America was a fledgling nation back in the latter part of the 1700s. But this long-term move to bring about a world government came about certainly with the First International, the Communist International, 1848, the Second International when the Socialist International was formed, and then he's been talking about the Third International, which was formed in 1918, under Lenin and Trotsky. So pick the story up there.
Okay. When they set up the Third International, they wanted to set up a program to complete the transformation of the entire world into a world organization. And that end game, I'll jump way ahead, was to be a world without nations, a world without nationalities, a world without competition, and a world without freedom, where you had total control of the people. And it was to be run by, I wouldn't say a ruling elite, it's an organizational hierarchy of people who were recruited into and served the system. And I might add that we're now well aware of what has happened in the United States since 9/11, and with the new Homeland Security organization out there, which is one of the most pervasive organizations in the United States today, they went back and brought in some of the experts from the communist world to assist in setting up that Homeland Security, because where have you had a real type of Homeland Security more than you have had in the communist world countries?
Why would we bring communists into America to try to preserve our freedom?
Well, the Stasi in East Germany, General Marcus Wolff, was brought in as he was Minister of State Security in East Germany, and he was one of the consultants. KGB General Primakov, KGB General Kalugin, General Karpov.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here with our special guest, General Ben Parton. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and General Parton was just talking about with the advent of the Patriot Act, and of course in an effort to protect us from the wicked terrorists, of course, how there's so many terrorists, that's why we don't even bother to seal the borders down there, because there's so many terrorists, they might get in if we seal the border, or maybe we can't really understand if there's really a war on terrorism, why won't they seal the border? Why do they do everything they can to block our pilots on our airplanes from carrying weapons? Why won't they let the airlines, target people who are of Muslim, the racial profiling is what they call it, but it would be logical, probably most of the terrorists are going to be Muslim. You would think that they would be, racially profiling people, but the government, of course, will fine any airline who tries to do racial profiling. All they're doing is collecting more and more information on law-abiding citizens in the name of fighting terrorism. And Dr. Parton, General Parton, was saying that they brought in some very, very key people from the Soviet Union and their satellites to help set up our system of the Patriot system and all the Office of Homeland Security laws. And General, why would they bring these people from these totalitarian countries?
Looking to set up a tightly controlled society. Those people have more experience in that than so that's why they were brought in. All of that is spelled out. One of the first places it was published in the International Currency Review. Back there, it's been advertised quite extensively since then, but that information has been out a long time. You don't see it in the press. You won't hear it on, as you said, on Hannity and Cohn's or any of those people. They're not going to talk about it. But you've had over a period of time so much disinformation, so much management of the news. You have a psychopolitical warfare going on, and many things that are conducted, just like the Sino-Soviet split, it's really psychopolitical warfare. Because if you can convince the West that Russia and China, I'm talking about back in the 50s when it was set up, that Russia and China were at each other's throat, then your military preparedness and requirements and your threat was entirely different if you could depend on them nullifying each other's effectiveness, because you're not dealing with a dual threat, you're dealing with part of the one or part of the other. And then China entered into the picture, and you have the same thing there. They were operating cooperatively together, and Russia could work better in one country in Africa, and China could work better in a country in South America. And you had a program laid out that covered every single country and every type of country in the world to transform them. Now, the program called for what you're doing in setting up this new world order. They call for what you do in business, industry, agriculture, banking, a world bank, a global banking system, one bank, one global banking system. You cover almost all areas of endeavor in that program. But as a military guy, my primary concern was what is their system for effectively transforming the power base from the democratic countries out there, or republic countries out there, into the communist or socialist or global hierarchy of countries. And that's where my focus was, and why I tracked it so thoroughly was because it had a big effect on what you needed in weapons and what your weapons requirements should be in military systems.
Well, of course, here in the United States, we always had a limited system of government, a restriction of the power of the federal government, but every communist has always worked here in the United States to increase the power in Washington, D.C. Why do you think it is the communists and the socialists are so intent upon destroying our constitutional system of limited government and centralizing all power with Washington, D.C.?
Well, I just have been working with someone on the West Coast on a book called The Clash of Civilizations. And really, you're dealing with, if you look at the psychopolitics of these things, you're dealing with people out there who have this natural propensity in many respects, and they get educated that way too and led that way, to be individualist, as many people were in the United States, versus the collectivist, which is what the socialists push. And those two basic concepts are what the war is all about. Those people who do not believe in the free and independent man, think everything ought to be collectivized and run by the state or hierarchy of states, and there's the war. And you have it in business, industry, agriculture, banking, everywhere.
But of course, we find a lot of people of great wealth who really believe in this system. They want to centralize all power in government, and then they want to buy and sell the politicians to control the government.
I remember in 1958, we had the New Horizon Study, which was the Air Force-run study, looking ahead 20 years. What would be the threat 20 years from now? And what weapons would we have? And what would technology permit? And what would we be vulnerable to in technological surprise? That study was at Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and I was the chair, technical secretary for the Weapons Committee and Committee on Limited War. And we had some very brilliant people out there. Say we run about 300 of the top scientists in the country through there, but some were way off in left field, and many of them were real great American patriots. And I remember Dr. Thompson, who was my boss at the time, he was the chief scientist on the Polaris program at the time, and he said, when we left, he was wanting to know what he could do for me career-wise, because I'd done a good job, he thought, up there. And I said, well, I wanted him to answer one question for me. I said, there'd been some really great American patriots been through there, and there are a lot of people who I suspected their motivation and some of the crazy things that they were pushing. And he said, well, one thing you have to always believe is that all of these people believe that they're promoting what they think is right for the country.
But, of course, there's some people who really want to destroy our way of life and really establish an authoritarian system here, just like they have in other socialist countries.
Well, sure. Well, it doesn't have to be a socialist country to have an authoritarian form of government. We have all kinds of authoritarian groups out there, but the communist world has this ideological, organized thought that is very, very pervasive. And they push for the collectivization of things all over the world, and to be culminated. And you know, they change their language. They play with things out there. I know that Well, I won't get into that now.
All right, fine.
I'd like to go back and stick with the program. Unless we get through and organize and cover the, what that program is, we'll be running up a bunch of...
All right, well, let's what is the program?
The program, as they laid out, and I'm going to address the part of the program that is focused on transforming countries into transforming countries into this global system. As I said before, I'm not talking about what they're doing in banking. I'm not talking about what they're doing in a lot of specific areas. But I'm talking about what they're doing to transform a country, take that country from its free self-government into this cooperative, collusive, new world order. And they laid out all the countries, identified all the countries in the world, in the three different categories. This is between 1918 and 1928. When they set up the Third International in 1918, they pulled together a committee of their best and brightest from around the world. Now, these weren't people from Russia. These were people from all over the world who participated in this elite group who were going to be designing and laying out the country for transforming the world. And in 1928, they had had 11 plenary sessions and had developed the program, and I think it was the Fifth Party Congress a couple of years before that. They had circulated the draft, and it was finally put in final form and approved at the Party Congress in Moscow 1 September 1928. There were over 500 delegates from around the world. There were 25 delegates from the United States. Only 20 of them had voting privileges. And they adopted the program of the Third International. Now, one of the major strategies for transforming countries is what they call wars of national liberation. And they published a separate document, which is even far more pages than that document on transforming countries by war of national liberation, than there was in the total program. But it was approved as a supplementing document on the very same day, September 1st, 1928. And there's a third document dealing with the racial problems around the world, particularly with respect to Africa and the United States and how the countries were going to be transformed in Africa and some places, other places, on the racial basis as a basis for a war of national liberation. Now, they divided the world, into three different categories. One was the capitalist world. And they considered the capitalist world to be Western Europe, Australia, and Japan. There are a couple of exceptions. The United States was considered primarily a colonial country because of the racial and different disparate groups inside the United States. You have a black group, a Hispanic group, a Chinese groups, American Indian groups that they were trying to develop in a cult into a revolutionary faction in the United States, which had more of the quality of a war of national liberation than it did for the strategy they're using for the capitalist world. And the strategy for the capitalist world was to infiltrate, infuse, and exploit the electoral process, exploit the legislative process, and democratic processes.
Would you think that this is one reason why they've encouraged unbridled immigration into the United States, so there'd be more groups that they could play against one another for this coming revolution that they envision?
That part, but that plays more into the hands of war of national liberation than it does in the capitalist world. In the capitalist world, there was all democratic process, and if you look at today, the big array of former countries that they considered in the capitalist world, most of those countries, in particular in Europe, have a socialist chief of state today.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment. Our guest is General Ben Parton. We're going to be talking about the plan to spread communism throughout the world. Well, General Parton, please pick up the story there.
Well, I think I want to correct one thing. The plan. It's not a plan. It's a program.
And all right.
This is the one thing everybody needs to distinguish. When you go to a theater, they give you a program. They don't give you a blueprint. They don't give you a plan. It's a program. And that represents the fact that you have a cast that's putting on a play, you have a theater, you've sold tickets, you have some program or a story that's going to be told on the stage, and you're going to completion and do that. You're going to produce that play. And that is the difference between a program and, say, a plan. A plan, you can have a plan to build a house. You can have a blueprint to build a house. But unless you put together the program to get it built and funded and have workers and everything to do the job, you don't have a program. So you must distinguish between a plan and a program. A program is something entirely different.
All right, fine. So why don't you go ahead and then destroying the plan. Describing the plan.
The program.
I wish you could, of course, go ahead and destroy it, but go ahead.
But the capitalist world out there, most of the countries that were indicated in the capitalist world have been transitioned to socialism or have at least a socialist chief of state. Most of those countries today. Now, the second group of countries was the countries that they call the medium level of development. They were countries that had a fairly stable government. They've had a history of fairly sophisticated governments, a good balance between business, industry, and agriculture. And most of those were the East European countries. There are a number of others scattered around the world. But most of those were the East European countries. And they were to be transitioned on a power structure based on militant unionism, establishing extensive co-ops in business, industry, and agriculture to break the profit motive and profit of businesses, and a whole bunch of other things that they were doing. And they started trying to pick those countries off before World War II. In fact, you had the Podolsky Affair, they moved into Finland, you recall, and they were trying to transition those countries into the Soviet bloc then, and that's really what triggered World War II. Remember, Stalin and Hitler split Poland, but that was part of this global strategy there for exploiting these kinds of countries at the median level of development. But all of those countries transitioned to socialism as a direct consequence of World War II and some of the giveaway policies that were exercised in negotiating with the Soviets after World War II. At Potsdam and other places, many of those countries transitioned to socialism. Now, the last group of countries are what they call colonial or semi-colonial. We all know what a colonial country is. It's a populous or country dominated by a foreign power. But a semi-colonial country is a free and independent nation that falls under the dominant influence of a major power. So everything in the Western Hemisphere essentially fell within the dominant influence of the United States. We had a Monroe Doctrine back then, and so all of those countries, were semi-colonial countries in the Western Hemisphere, were to be transitioned to socialism by a war of national liberation. And that includes most of the world. If you look at the restricted number of countries that they considered to be countries at the median level of development, that was only a very small chunk of the world. The capitalist countries was only a small hunk of the world. The most pervasive and most extensive organizational structure out there to transition countries into socialism.
Well, that's all. Just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and just General Parton was talking about the wars of liberation that would be fought in the colonial countries, and there were so many countries that really were dominated by other countries, and most of the countries here in the Western Hemisphere were dominated by the United States. So pick the story up there, General Parton.
The number of colonial countries was small compared to the number of semi-colonial countries. Most of the world was considered was semi-colonial, but a lot were colonial. So, for the strategy for transforming countries by war of national liberation, that's the colonial and semi-colonial countries, they laid out a three-phase program, and you go through one phase. You get to a point, a transition point, you go to a next phase, you get a transition point, and then you move into the third phase. Now, the transition points are different primarily for each one of these liberation struggles. But you go through definitely a first phase. And phase one of a war of national liberation I call it phase zero, but they establish that you some revolutionary basis to exercise a struggle, liberating struggle from something in that nation. And if there's no faction that you can organize around, they will generate a faction. For a war of national liberation, you must have some internal schism, or that you can exacerbate to develop a revolutionary crisis.
Would you talk about this? Be financial? Would it be racial? Would it be monetary? Would it be?
It depends on the country.
All right.
It depends on the country.
But within whatever it is, they will develop it. They will exploit it because they're really not interested in helping the people. They're interested in controlling the people, aren't they?
That's right. One of the dirtiest words in the communist vernacular is reform. They are not after reform. Anything is a reform will lessen the hostility. So you do not want to reform. You want to exacerbate the conflict thesis.
And they don't really want a solution. They want a problem.
Well, you have to have the problem to exercise the revolutionary process.
Right.
So you start off by infiltrating and recruiting and organizing. It's all nonviolent. You try to establish control of the media. You exacerbate whatever conflict thesis you have. You establish a revolutionary justification. And if you don't have a revolutionary justification, you generate it. You start off with peaceful demonstrations and propaganda. You work to subvert the culture, the religion, the education, the politics, their values, their military, and their law enforcement. All of those are sort of the heart of the country. Then you undermine business, industry, and agriculture, and the family. All of those are basic foundations. Then you subvert the institutions out there, disseminate disinformation, employ strategic deception. And strategic deception is just what the Sino-Soviet split was. Now, communism is dead. That is what they call strategic deception.
And of course, that way that, of course, when we said there was a split between the Chinese communists and the Russian communists, and we could give money and technology to the Chinese, you know, to use against the Russians, money and technology to the Russians to use against the Chinese, and they were really building up both countries eventually to come against us.
Well, many, many of the countries, that's right. But, let me step through some of the other things that they do here in the preparatory phase. Disseminating disinformation, employing strategic deception, environmentalism. Environmentalism is probably the biggest global communist front in the world. And it is probably one of the biggest problems that's generated and has worked diligently trying to establish energy dependence in the United States. You know, one of the reasons why we have the problem today, we haven't built refineries. We have worked against the left scientific community has been conducting a war against fusion power. When the new Schroeder took over in Germany, he came out of East Germany. One of the first things he knew, he's a hardcore leftist, he came out of East Germany. He was moved to shut down the nuclear power plants in Germany. Do what? Create energy dependence. So they play all these tricks to weaken and make the country more vulnerable to a war of national liberation. But the last two things that you always try to do in a war of national liberation in the preparatory phase, you try to remove the death penalty, because when you move from the death penalty, from the preparatory phase into the period of escalating violence, which is the second phase, if you get caught in terrorist acts, and terrorism plays a big role in the second phase, you might get executed, but if there's no death penalty, the worst thing a revolutionary has to fear is being caught and locked up and goes to jail. But when the revolution goes to completion, he has the hopes of being another Nelson Mandela or Castro or some commissar or something.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is General Ben Parton. He's talking about the preparatory stages for the communists taking over countries and how they play the whole system. It's all very well organized. They go step by step, don't they?
The last thing you always try to do in a war of national liberation, in the preparatory phase, is to disarm the citizenry. If you have everybody is armed, and that's why the founding fathers of this country wanted to guarantee that we would have an armed citizenry. And if you have an armed citizenry, the magnitude of the effort to overthrow it just becomes astronomical compared to the effort out there required if you do not have an armed citizenry.
And, of course, there's really not very many people within these movements, and they want to control by force, and they do not want any opposition from the public. And you can see in every communist country when they take over, for part of that, they disarm the people.
In Rwanda, they could disarm the people. How were people killed? The people out there who had the machetes. The most popular weapon of mass destruction that has been used so far to kill the most people was the machete in Rwanda. In, 3-4 weeks, they killed over 1 million people. Over 1 million, nearly. They first announced 500,000. But I was told by a group down there that it was 800,000, and after the count was completed, it was just a little over 1 million people killed with machetes because the people were disarmed. Brutal, very, very brutal.
And of course, they're doing everything they can to disarm the American people today. We got all these people who sworn to uphold our Constitution who are saying, "Oh, we got to disarm the people. If we could just take the weapons away from people, we wouldn't have any violence." But I always like to say, you know, the first thing, you disarm the criminals, and then you take the weapons away from the law-abiding citizens. And somebody said, "Well, that wouldn't work because the criminals wouldn't turn in their weapons." Go right ahead, General.
I mentioned before, in the preparatory phase, ecology, or the environmental movement has played a very major role in many areas, and people aren't conscious of it or cognizant of it. But Gus Hall wrote a book in 1972, that's over 34 years ago. It was entitled Ecology. Many people didn't know what ecology was back then. Subtitle, Can We Survive Under Capitalism? And he said right off the bat, in the first part of the book, he says, the crisis of the environment, like other crises, has its roots in the inherent characteristics of capitalism. The drive for private profits, which insists on the exploitation...
Well, that's all right there, General. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Arthur Stan, and General Partner is talking about a book that was written by Gus Hall, who was the head of the American Communist Party, and he was talking about, environmentalism. What did he didn't call it environmentalism. What did he call it?
Ecology.
Ecology. And really that, there's certainly that this whole movement could be utilized to further their goal, and they really are using the environmental movement because the solution to every environmental problem we face is a new set of government laws to regulate the individual. That's what it's all about.
Well, right up front in the book, he says, the drive for profit motives, which insist on the exploitation and racism and promotes war and domestic violence, also includes an utterly reckless disregard for natural resources and the consequent contamination of the environment. So the profit motive of private business is the cause of the pollution problem.
But I guess if you go to Russia and you go to China, they're the biggest polluters in the world. I mean, the collectivist countries are certainly the most irresponsible as far as the environment is concerned.
That's been particularly true of the Soviet Union.
Right.
In the middle of the book, he says the ultimate solution, of course, is the creation of a planned society in which the quest for profits has been abolished and the results of our science and technology are used for the benefit of the masses of the people of our nation. So, the solution to the problem is you've got to socialize. You've got to, the country. Go to this planned society. You know. And the last thing in the book, right at the toward the end, he said, it is my hope that all of you people who have been trained in the struggle, well, the environmental struggle, will be there and ready for participation in the next phases of the revolution.
And that was written in the 70s, and boy, they've sure played this whole environmental card from global warming up till the ozone hole to, too many people in the world to, protecting the air from pollution, but the use of oil and gasoline.
Well, you know, if you're going to do something dastardly, is destroy all the countries and the governments and the civilizations you have, and put together a new form, a new moral order, or amoral order, whichever you want to call it, you can plan to do those things. Plan evil like you can plan good. Now, the second phase of a war of national liberation is what they call the period of escalating violence. And if you'd think for a moment, one recent war of national liberation, it went through this process, was South Africa. And they moved from the preparatory phase, which was long-term, to the period of escalating violence when Mandela was turned out of jail. It was just a few years between the time he was turned out of jail, it's 4.5 or so years, between the time he was turned out of jail until he was elected president, they had about 18,000 homicides. Remember when they had all the necklacing? If you weren't politically correct, you could be necklaced back there. Take a tire and soak it in gasoline and put it on somebody around somebody's neck and set it on fire. We saw lots and lots of pictures of people being necklaced, and it was talked about a lot back there when it was going on. And when the period of escalating violence in South Africa lasted from the time Mandela was let out of jail until he became president. Castro moved from the period of escalating violence when he came down out of the hills in around end of 59 and 1960, and took over in Cuba. That was the end of the period of escalating violence in Cuba. But the end of the period of escalating violence in South Africa was when Mandela got elected president. What do you do in the period of escalating violence? You start off with political assassinations, bank robberies, kidnappings for ransom. Now, how many industrialists and wealthy people out there have had their cars armored all over the Western Hemisphere? A lot in Europe also. Kidnappings for ransom. Terrorism. Terrorism plays a major role in the period of escalating violence.
Of course, General, most people don't know that Nelson Mandela is a lifelong communist. When he got into power, why, there was Fidel Castro, and there was Gaddafi of Algeria, and there were the communist leaders from all over the world, and there, was, of course, was Hillary Clinton, all congratulating Nelson Mandela, who was a lifelong communist.
Yeah, the three primary leaders of the communist revolution in South Africa was Nelson Mandela. Joe Slovo was a KGB colonel, and Joe Slovo and Nelson Mandela and Bishop Tutu.
Right.
Now, Bishop Tutu gave the main Christmas Eve program at the National Cathedral in Washington 2 or 3 years ago. Here he was, the Christmas Eve program at the National Cathedral in Washington. And he says in his speech, he says, "It is my hope he made some point about in the future you see the banners lifted across the country raised saying from each according to his need, to each according to his need, and from each according to their ability."
That comes right out of the Communist Manifesto.
Well, it comes right out of the program of the Third International. Well, it came from Karl Marx.
Right.
But it's in spelled out specifically just that way in the program of the Third International. And here is, he called it, those great Christian values are from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. And it's the communist propaganda means of taking over and taking control.
But terrorism,
Lenin said, you may kill individuals, but you intimidate thousands with terrorism.
But, General Parton, the thing is that the American media was all behind Nelson Mandela, and to this very day, the vast majority of the American people have no idea that Nelson Mandela was a lifelong communist. He even got a Nobel Peace Prize as a great humanitarian, yet he was a lifelong terrorist, and that's why they wouldn't let him out of prison, was because he refused to agree to give up terrorism.
When they locked him up, he was manufacturing 250,000 hand grenades.
Right.
But anyway, intimidation. Terrorism gives you intimidation, demoralization. And one thing in terrorism, you try to establish that you have no mercy. Lenin said, if you want to, Trotsky in his book, Terrorism, Terrorism, written by Leon Trotsky. The basic thesis of the book, Terrorism, was supporting terrorism.
And of course, you want to get everybody frightened to death, so they'll give up their freedom.
And he said, if you want to have obedience, you establish that you have no mercy. That comes straight from Trotsky's book. Establish that you have no mercy, and you will get obedience. Destabilization of countries by refugees. Destabilization. Are we being destabilized in the United States? You bet we are. Inflow of people, money, and equipment. That has to come from outside sources. Guerrilla warfare. You escalate the violence. You move into guerrilla warfare, urban guerrilla warfare, limited warfare, until you transform power to some revolutionary council or elect your communist-controlled leadership. Now, once you establish control, the communists have control now. They have the means to exercise the police powers, and they can control, and people are disarmed. You move into what they call the period of exploitation. Exploitation. Castro has been in the period of exploitation since 1960. What was he doing? Bringing people in from the United States, from Middle America, South America, training them in Cuba, sending them back, or sending them to Russia or China or somewhere for training, and sending them back to their own countries for carrying out revolutionary processes and getting ready for the revolutionary processes there. So what do you do in this period of exploitation? You liquidate your opposition. You liquidate or re-educate your potential opposition. Remember what they did in Korea right after the communists took over there? All these people were liquidated or put in re-education centers. You work toward perfecting this so-called new socialist man. Then you have to have all this political correctness to conform to the ideological basis of socialism and communism. That's where political correctness comes into power.
Of course, do they use the children in school? Do they program the children and the college students?
Well, sure. Everywhere. Political correctness, enforcing the communist ideology and the communist way of life and all those things. Getting rid of religion. Political correctness was coined by Felix Dzerzhinsky for that purpose back when he was the first head of the Cheka, which later became the KGB, evolved to the KGB. But that was Felix Dzerzhinsky. And political correctness plays a very important role in the period of exploitation and getting the ideological alignment of the people formed. Now, that's why you have right today political correctness with respect to separation of church and state. Separation of church and state is not in the Constitution of the United States. The Founding Fathers were guaranteeing in our Constitution that you weren't going to have any preference shown by the state for any of the denominations over here. But the separation of church and state, what does it mean? It means what the communists say it means because it's in their Constitution. The Constitution of the Soviet Union, all three of them, they had three during the period of time, had three constitutions. Every one of them called for the separation of church and state, the separation of church and school, and guarantee the right of the citizens and the government to conduct anti-religious propaganda. Well, under that system, you burned thousands and thousands of churches down, you persecuted, liquidated, got rid of the Christian leadership in Russia and all these other places. So political correctness is a powerful tool of the communist world, and you see it being imposed in the United States, and people speak very glibly about political correctness, but it's a very basic psychopolitical warfare tool.
But General, why are so many of our newspapers pushing this whole collectivist
socialist idea? They're part of the problem. You know, way back after the turn of the century, you had big meetings of the left, not just in this country, around the world, trying to establish what do we have to do, what media, how much of the media we have to control public opinion. And that's been underway for 100 years. So it's so deeply seated, and it's been bought out so many years ago, and the big banking people had a lot to do with this. because they were an instrument of this all these wars of national liberation. Going back to the things that they do in this period of exploitation, you work toward the perfectibility of the so-called new socialist man, and you provide a basis for operations for the next target countries. In other words, just like Castro in Cuba, he has been training and funding people back into South America and the Middle Americas and Venezuela. You have a new communist government in Venezuela. And Brazil, if you examine what's going on in Brazil and for years, I don't see why it really hasn't completely turned over yet. But many of the countries in South America are either effectively transitioned or in the latter part of the phase three of this preparatory phase, phase two and three of the preparatory phase. You support the World Commonwealth of Independent States. The CIS, the program called for, they had hoped to have, the only date you find associated with the program of Third International back there was when they expected and hoped to have and were working to have what they called a World Commonwealth of Independent States by the year 2000. So they were working 28 to 2000, that's 80 years, you know. No, well, we started in 18 was the when they set up the study group, but it's 28 when they adopted the program. And but their goal was to have this World Commonwealth of Independent States for the year 2000. So you have to think about how long-range program they were working on. And unless you visualize and think about that, you can be fooled about the media control out there. This thing has been going on for 100 years.
Trying to control
the media.
You mentioned that sometimes the big banks were involved. Why would the big banks be involved with pushing socialism?
Well, the Federal Reserve kind of system, we didn't have that until 1913. This country was founded on an entirely different monetary system. Everything was backed with gold and silver. But with the Federal Reserve in 1913, there's a big history about that. They set up the capability to manipulate credit and encumber debt so that the bankers had unlimited amount of money at no cost, essentially. So this was being done not just in the United States, it was being done around the world. So establishing that kind of banking system, Jefferson and Washington fought over this issue right after George Washington was still president, about how we're going to set up the banking system.
Alexander Hamilton, of course.
Alexander Hamilton, right. Not Jefferson. Alexander Hamilton was pushing for the Federal Reserve kind of system.
And, of course, Jefferson was against it.
Yeah, that's right. He was against it. Jefferson was against it, and George Washington finally went with Hamilton because he said it would be easier to fund and raise money to support the government. But he debated that, and he fought over himself internally for a long time. So you have this Commonwealth of Independent States as the objective. Now, what does the former Soviet Union, the former USSR, what do they call themselves today? The CIS. The CIS. What? Commonwealth of Independent States. That was what the objective was back there, to establish this World Commonwealth of Independent States. I was rather interested over at a military base fairly recently. All the guards had on their shoulder patches CIS. Well, CIS, I was sort of brainwashed, the CIS, the former Soviet Union, but over there there's a company whose initials are CIS. They were providing guards for the military installation. You get rid of, in this phase, you're getting rid of public ownership of property. Or getting rid of private ownership of property, going to public ownership of property. And you work to eliminate all religions, destroying the value systems.
Colonel, we're just about, General, we're just about out of time. Do you have a web page or any place you'd like people to go to get more information on what you're speaking of?
I can provide you a web page that can get a lot of information on this.
All right. If you could, why, of course, I'd like our listeners to be able to get the information you're talking about. Where would they go?
Well, the program of Third International is published in the documents of the Communist International. There are three volumes of those. Three volumes. And it's a number two volume that covers from 19. They're chronological. It covers from 1919 till 1943.
Okay. And so everything's right on schedule. We're moving away from freedom.
And you know, the documents, those documents have been maintained in publication by who? The Royal Institute of International Affairs. And who are they? They're the UK counterpart to the CFR.
The Council on Foreign Relations at 68 East 58th Street in New York. We'll be right back here in just a moment to wrap up today's program. Well, General, you've got about 3 minutes to wrap up the program. What message would you like to leave with our listeners?
Well, I want to say that we're not at the end of the ball game with respect to their program. And they were shooting for the CIS, World Commonwealth of Independent States, by the year 2000. Then they move into a period they call globalism, as you have a global corporate socialism, it's the global cartels for the production and distribution of goods and services. Then you move into a period of what they call interdependence. Once you have, you can establish these cartels, then you establish this total dependence within this world hierarchy of states, and they call that the World Socialist Division of Labor. And then you have the withering away of the state. Everybody in communist didn't heard about that.
Yeah, but it never seems to wither away.
Well, but then you move in after the world withering away of the state. You move into what they call a global hierarchy of regional governments. That's regional government. A global hierarchy of regional government. And that gives you world communism. That's this world without nations, a world without nationalities, a world without borders, a world without war, a world without competition, and a world without freedom. And from that, you can develop the so-called new socialist man.
But, of course, they had 70 years in Russia, almost three generations, and the state never withered away, and you never saw the new socialist man. You saw a lot of people who didn't want to work anymore. You saw a lot of deterioration in health. You saw the average age of a man in Russia is 58 years of age, but I don't see a new socialist man coming up.
Let me tell you a quick, cute story. We used to have these political conferences in Washington. There was one, and then they split up, and then they have two. And one of the new ones was more technical oriented in political politics, and Reed Irvine and several people in the Washington area, three people were heading that up. And I know one of them called me when he was putting out the program, and he sent me this letter with an outline of the program. And they had, this was about 3 years ago, and they had one panel meeting in the afternoon was going to discuss communism under the title "Communism is Dead, But What About the Residual Problems?" And I called him back and I said, "You can't have a panel on communism is dead without talking about what's dead and what's alive." And he told me he was fixing to go to Europe, and when he got back, he'd give me a call and we'd talk about it further. When he got back, he never talked to me. So I attended the panel meeting when they had the big meeting in Washington, and I know Reed Irvine was chairing the panel, and
hold that thought. We're just going to have to bring our stations back on board, and then we'll have to wrap things up. But I want you to finish the story.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and the general partner is saying that he's attending a meeting in Washington, D.C. on how communism is dead. Now, this is about 3 years ago. Reed Irvine had not yet passed away. So tell the rest of the story.
I know that when they finished their panel discussions, I know Reed was chairing the meeting at the time, and I stood up and asked the same question I had asked originally. I said, about how can you have a meeting without discussing what's real and what's dead? And the person who I talked to, and he said, Reed said, well, I didn't have anything to do with the program. That was, he told me the name of the individual who had been a longtime friend of mine, still is. And had him stand up and ask him to stand up and answer the question. Well, he's a very articulate individual, In fact, he was a national committee man at the time, and he couldn't get out of Senate. And he turned to this another lady there who had been practically a street revolutionary back in the 50s and 60s and was now one of the big powerful neocons in this country. She stood up and said, well, in my generation, we believe in the perfectibility of the Soviet man. But when you go to the Soviet Union today, the Soviet man is a bureaucrat, alcoholic bureaucrat who won't work, and sat down.
And that's really how it all ends up, because it's a beautiful dream, but between man's plan and time and God's plan and eternity.
But they're still striving.
They're still striving. Well, God bless you. Thank you so very much for being with us, Colonel. It's been a real pleasure. General, I'm sorry. Thank you so much for being with us. Our guest is Ben DeSedwell. Ben Parton. Bye-bye and God bless. All right, well, this is Dr. Stan, and General Parton's a good friend. And anyway, if you really want to see how it fits together, the book Foundations, Their Power and Influence, one of the five most important books in my library, and Foundations, Their Power and Influence, goes into how people of great wealth, the great tax-exempt foundation, have been financing communism since its inception. You'll need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, where we point out that communism was actually financed from its beginning, from right here in the United States and Great Britain, and wealthy people throughout the world. You need to get the book, The Best Enemies Money Could Buy. We carry it. We also have a video by the same name, my interview with Professor Sutton, who points out that communism was always funded from America. Why? We wanted an enemy. You have all of these theories about communism. Oh, my goodness, you know, we're going to take over the world. But really, of course, they were controlled opposition. Why? Because the ultimate goal was the establishment of a one-world dictatorship under a ruling financial elite. And the very people that the communists thought that they were fighting were actually financing their movement and encouraging it in our universities and our schools across America. The one book you have to read, Foundations, Their Power and Influence. The second book would be Brotherhood of Darkness, and then The Best Enemies Money Could Buy, going into how we financed the Vietnamese. The North Vietnamese during the Vietnam War. We financed Russia, who's financing the North Vietnamese. We're building up communist China today. Read your Wall Street Journal and see how our biggest banks are all funding the Chinese communist banks and Chinese communist movements. And our great corporations are. It's the same thing all over again. It's like deja vu all over again. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. The book's Foundations, Their Power and Influence. Brotherhood of Darkness. The Best Enemies Money Could Buy. They're all available from Radio Liberty. And understand how this whole thing works together. Nothing is as it appears to be. And we're moving rapidly towards an authoritarian society in what was once the land of the free and the home of the brave. America brought the communists to power in Russia. We backed Mugabe, and we brought him to power in Rhodesia, now called Zimbabwe. We brought Mandela to power in South Africa. We are financing communism all throughout the world. But we can't let the American people know that any more than we can let them know who's really funding the terrorists who are killing American boys in Iraq today. Pray for America, pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.